of Father Coughlin, much less listened to him. Nightline just made it up. In fact, the closest any member of the Buchanan family has ever come to listening to an anti-Semitic radio broadcast was the time Pat accidentally tuned into NPR. Responding to a series of calumnies in the Nightline broadcast in a press conference 6 days later, Bay Buchanan, Pat's sister, said, "Neither Pat nor I have ever heard my father refer to the late Father Charles Coughlin, the so-called radio priest of the 1930s. And the first time Pat ever heard of this fellow was when he went to New York City to do graduate work and studied about him at that time." She continued, "Somebody tells me that my father spoke about things in my home, and no one called to ask one of us if it's ever been done in our home and puts it on his television as fact." Even other members of the press, who know how mendacious they are, were stunned that no one from Nightline had even called to ask about the Father Coughlin story. Question: you're saying that no one from Nightline ever contacted you or anyone in your family prior to that airing? Bay Buchanan: nobody. No one. No one. That is correct. When told Nightline was standing by its report, Bay said, "Go ahead and stand by it. But somebody maybe should have some ethics here, some standards, some journalistic standards. Don't they exist anymore for Ted Koppel?" He could just put anything he wants on television without even making a phone call. This was evidently the first time Bay had ever seen Nightline. No one's been so unjustifiably shocked by a lie since the last time Jimmy Carter dealt with the Soviets. In a related story, the phrase "journalistic standards" recently set a new record for world's biggest oxymoron. Despite all the gobbledygook about the profession of journalism and the absurd conceit that journalism is a well-honed craft one has to master over time, the only standard journalists respect is, will this story promote the left-wing agenda? Like all good propagandists, the major media mix truth with lies and then make a big show of correcting trivial errors while doggedly refusing to issue corrections for the real whoppers. They stare into a camera and claim that they are professional enough to keep their reporting even-handed and then hide behind startled laughter when anyone calls them on it. After the New York Times star reporter Jason Blair was exposed as making up facts for his articles, the paper conducted an internal investigation to figure out how inaccurate reporting could have ended up in the august pages of the Times. During his first job interview at the Times, Blair said, "I still believe in a place called hope," which should have been a huge red flag for somebody. Apart from the catch-all, a failure of communication, and a reminder that the black kid was sneaky, the Times' main excuse for Blair's reporting was their claim that there had been few complaints from the subjects of Blair's articles. By few complaints, apparently what the Times means is there were lots of complaints about facially implausible facts reported in Blair's articles, but the editors decided not to issue any corrections. In one of the Times' major front-page articles on the Virginia/DC sniper investigation in October 2002, Blair reported that sniper John Muhammad had been on the verge of confessing to local officials when the U.S. Attorney's Office broke off the interrogation. It was a stunning revelation, showing an appalling disregard for justice by overeager officials in the Bush administration. Curiously, no other news organization had anything on this major story. The Associated Press and others picked up the Times' story, and soon the botched confession was being repeated in news outlets across the country, based solely on the fact that it had appeared in the pages of the New York Times. Slate magazine referred to the Abbott and Costello competition between state and federal law enforcement, stating, "Already, investigators have complained that the U.S. attorney's rush to file federal charges against Muhammad and Malvo cost them a possible confession." The Rocky Mountain News proclaimed, "Let the states prosecute the sniper," saying, "The overly eager actions of a U.S. attorney might have cost investigators a chance of obtaining a confession from John Muhammad." Meanwhile, the subject of the story, U.S. Attorney Thomas M. DiBiagio, was screaming from the rooftops that the story was patent nonsense. He issued a statement saying, "The allegations in the New York Times article today are false." Muhammad had not been about to confess, and in fact, DiBiagio said, there was no indication throughout the day that either of the individuals were yielding any useful information. FBI agent Gary Bald denied the Times' claim that federal officials were acting on orders from the White House and the Department of Justice. Numerous other unnamed government officials also contradicted the Times' account. Not only were the subjects of the article publicly denying Blair's article, legal commentators were remarking on the sheer implausibility of the Times' account. On CNN, Joe DiGenova called the Times' story hokum, saying that if there had been a confession about to occur, they never would have moved that suspect. Roy Black said, "I also don't believe anybody would interrupt in a confession going on." So here was a case where there were lots of public complaints from the subject of Blair's article, scores of on- and off-the-record denials, in addition to widespread skepticism from legal commentators. In response, the Times concluded, Blair's account was accurate. A correction to the story of how federal officials botched sniper John Muhammad's confession would not run until May 2003, more than 6 months after the story had run, and only when the Times was engulfed in the Jason Blair scandal. Even then, the Times issued a half-hearted correction, claiming that Blair's story was plainly accurate in its central point. Evidently, the central point was not the point considered central at the time, and which was repeated in newspapers across the country, to wit, that federal officials had broken off John Muhammad's interrogation as he was about to confess. The central point, according to the Times' correction, was simply that local and federal authorities were feuding over custody of the sniper suspects. That is not a story that, under ordinary circumstances, would make the front page. The Times is caught lying, so they lie to explain why they were lying. There were few complaints from the subjects of Blair's articles. This is like recommending a surgeon by saying why he hasn't killed anyone in almost a week. But even that wasn't true. It wasn't even plausible. The Times routinely ignores all complaints. The only reason Blair was exposed is that another member of the Fourth Estate, the San Antonio Express News, caught Blair plagiarizing its stories. On May 1st, Jason Blair submitted his letter of resignation, which began with the words, "To be or not to be," and ended with the words, "You won't have Jason Blair to kick around anymore." Indeed, just a few months after the Jason Blair scandal broke, the Times was again ignoring angry denials from the people quoted in articles. They're like cockroaches, these liberals. You stomp on them, they lie still for a few minutes, and then they start moving again. A Times article by Charlie LaDuff quoted Lieutenant Commander Mike Beadler as he headed off to Iraq, commenting on the anti-war protests. "It's war," Commander Beadler said, "and the nation is fat. No one is screaming for battery-powered cars," he added. The Times reporter then quoted Beadler's wife as she patted down her husband's collar, saying, "I'm just numb. I'll cry myself to sleep, I'm sure." Amazingly, LaDuff had gotten the perfect quote for an article titled, "As an American Armada Leaves San Diego, Tears Are the Rule of the Day." This is what's known among purveyors of the craft of journalism as a big whopper. When Beadler saw the article, like U.S. Attorney DiBiagio, he immediately wrote to the Times, strenuously denying virtually every aspect of LaDuff's account. His alleged comments about national fatness and battery-powered cars, he said, were completely fabricated by Mr. LaDuff. According to Beadler, he simply said, "Protesters have a right to protest, and our job is to defend those rights. But in protesting, they shouldn't protest blindly. Instead, they should provide reasonable solutions to the problem," all of which sounds suspiciously unlike "the nation is fat." Beadler denied that his wife had said she would cry herself to sleep, and even pointed out that his wife did not pat down my collar either, which was impossible for her to accomplish with my civilian shirt hidden under my jacket and a duffel bag hanging on my shoulder closest to her. After thoroughly looking into Beadler's complaint, senior editor Bill Borders wrote back to Beadler, saying Mr. LaDuff thinks that he accurately represented his interview with you and your wife, and therefore so do I. Thus, a man in New York who had never met the Beadlers described for them a conversation they recently had with a reporter in San Diego. Borders then returned to his primary task of polishing up the New Times slogan, "All the news that's fit to print, and then some." No correction ever ran. If not for the Internet, no one would know the Times simply invented the Beadler's quotes. The principal goal of Times reporters is to prevent an articulate opposition statement to escape into the world. As long as you can't get them to admit they're lying, they say you can't prove they're lying. They respond with such mystification to corrections of their lies, it is legitimate to ask, how intelligent are the people reporting the news, these constitutionally protected guardians of the truth? Great Gray Lady in Spat with Saloon Hussy, November 20th, 2002. I did not realize how devastating the midterm elections were to liberals until seeing the Great Gray Lady reduced to starting a catfight with Fox News Channel. It has come to this. The New York Times was in high dudgeon this week upon discovering that Fox News chairman Roger Ailes sent a letter to the Bush White House 9 days after September 11th. As the corpses of thousands of his fellow Americans lay in smoldering heaps, Ailes evidently recommended getting rough with the terrorists. One imagines Karl Rove running down the hallway to the president's office, waving Ailes's letter and shouting, "Mr. President, Mr. President, I have the memo. We've got to fight back." I assume it's superfluous to mention that there is nothing illegal about Ailes giving advice to the president, though admittedly I have not consulted the living Constitution in the past 24 hours to see if a new penumbra specifically about Fox News has sprouted. But the Times was a monument of self-righteous indignation because hard newsmen are supposed to stay neutral between America and terrorists. Of course, the Times hasn't been reticent in giving the president advice on the war. Surrender now. Other great moments in journalistic neutrality include NPR's Nina Totenberg leaking information about Anita Hill that she got from Senator Howard Metzenbaum's staff, and the Washington Post's Ben Bradley yucking it up on the phone with President Kennedy and later cheering when President Nixon resigned. So it's interesting that the Times viewed Ailes' letter as an affront to objective journalism. But this was more than the media's usual insane point that they, the least impartial industry in America, must maintain absolute neutrality between George Bush and the terrorists. The Times went further to imply that by supporting his own country in the war on terrorism, Ailes had unmistakably marked himself as a partisan conservative. If Ailes had written a letter recommending a tax hike, a new hate crimes law, or going easy on the terrorists, I assume the Times would not have accused Ailes of showing a conservative bias. Instead, he had recommended the harshest measures possible against the terrorists. As far as the Times was concerned, this was the smoking gun of partisanship. The paper railed that Ailes purports to be an unbiased journalist, not a conservative spokesman. Fox News is the self-proclaimed fair and balanced news channel. But now the Times had caught him red-handed, pursuing an undisguised ideological agenda. Ailes is secretly rooting for America. At least we finally have it from the horse's own mouth. The Times openly admits that the conservative position, but not the liberal position, is to take America's side against the terrorists. Why do they get so snippy when I say that? The Times was a whirligig of pointless insinuations, secretly gave advice to, back-channel message, shocking, confirmed yesterday, and revelations. Eager Times readers will have to wait another day for any revelations about Pinch Sulzberger's SAT scores. Belittling Fox News is so pleasurable for the Times that it didn't occur to them that they had given up the ghost on their faux patriotism. It is simply taken for granted that liberals root against their own country. As the Times said of Ailes's letter, it was less shocking than it was liberating, a little like the moment in 1985 when an ailing Rock Hudson finally explained that he had AIDS. Same back at you. We always knew you were traitors, and now you've admitted it. Fox News should agree to admit it is conservative if all other media outlets will admit they are liberal. Fox is manifestly closer to the center than others. Referring here to the Times' definition of conservative, harsh with the terrorists, and liberal, soft on the terrorists, I believe the public is with Fox News. We took a pretty conclusive poll on that a couple of weeks ago. The people, in their infinite wisdom, have spoken. How a white male from Alabama learned the craft of journalism from a young reporter named Jason Blair. May 14, 2003. The New York Times is to be commended for ferreting out Jason Blair, the reporter recently discovered to be making up facts, plagiarizing other news organizations, and lying about non-existent trips and interviews. A newspaper that employs Maureen Dowd can't have had an easy time settling on Blair as the scapegoat. Blair's record of inaccuracies, lies, and distortions made him a candidate for either immediate dismissal or his own regular column on the op-ed page. The editors have set up a special email address for readers to report falsehoods they discover in Jason Blair articles. Okay, but how about setting up one for Paul Krugman? The Times ought to seize the moment and claim all those front-page articles predicting a quagmire in Iraq were also written by Blair. The Times has now willingly abandoned its mantle as the newspaper of record. It was already up against the Internet and LexisNexis as a research tool. But with Jason Blair, it has managed to leapfrog beyond mere technological obsolescence. All the Times had left was its reputation for accuracy. As this episode shows, the Times is not even attempting to preserve a reliable record of events. Instead of being a record of history, the Times is merely a record of what liberals would like history to be. The Pentagon in crisis. A quagmire in Iraq. Global warming is melting the North Pole. Protests roil the Augusta National Golf Club. Publisher Arthur Pinch Sulzberger has turned the paper into a sort of bulletin board for Manhattan liberals. In the Soviet-style reporting preferred at the Times, its self-investigation of the Blair scandal included copious denials that race had anything to do with it. Mr. Boyd, managing editor, said last week that the decision to advance Mr. Blair had not been based on race. Mr. Blair's Times supervisors emphasized that he earned an internship at the Times because of glowing recommendations and a remarkable work history, not because he is black. Did Jason Blair write the article on the investigation of Jason Blair? The very next sentence notes that the Times offered Blair a slot in an internship program that was then being used in large part to help the paper diversify its newsroom. If the Times' diversity program did not consider Blair's race, then it wasn't much of a diversity program, now was it? This is like job advertisements that proclaim, "Equal opportunity, affirmative action, employer." Well, which is it? In one of several feverish editorials supporting the University of Michigan's race-based admissions program, the Times denounced the Bush administration for imagining that diversity can be achieved without explicitly taking race into account. Any diversity program that failed to do so, the Times lectured, was necessarily flawed. But then it gets caught publishing Jason Blair, and the Times demurely insists that its own affirmative action program scrupulously ignored race. Oh, okay. The Times not only expressly took race into account, but also put Blair's race above everything, accuracy, credibility, and the paper's reputation. It hired a kid barely out of college. In fact, it turns out Blair was not yet out of college. He had no professional journalistic experience except at the Times. He screwed up over and over again, and the paper had to print over 50 corrections to articles he'd written. Despite all this, Blair was repeatedly published on the front page, promoted, and sent love notes from the editor-in-chief, Howell Raines. Ignoring the warnings of a few intrepid whistleblowers, top management kept assigning Blair to bigger stories in new departments without alerting the editors to Blair's history because, as Raines said, it would stigmatize him. Speaking of stigmas, after this scandal, does the demand for black heart surgeons go up or down? Raines jettisoned the Times' famous slogan, preferring the slogan, "The New York Times, now with even more black people." Publisher Sulzberger summed up the episode with these words, "The person who did this is Jason Blair. Let's not begin to demonize our executives." To put that in plain English, even though we hired him, we promoted him, and we covered up for him, and even though it's our name on the masthead, we assume absolutely no responsibility for any of this whatsoever. If mismanagement at Enron had been this clear-cut, the Times would be demanding the death penalty for Ken Lay. Indeed, taking a page from all corporate chieftains caught in scandals, the Times insists that the organization is fine. It was just one bad apple. As I recall, the Times editorial page did not accept that explanation when Merrill Lynch said it about Henry Blodgett. Raines's behavior is far worse than the corporate chieftains. He clearly bears the most responsibility for this fiasco, but when disaster strikes, he blames the black kid. So far, Raines's response has been basically to say, "You try to help these people." Raines's other great contribution to race relations was his unintentionally comical magazine piece about his black maid, Grady's Gift. It is absolutely Clintonian. Just as Clinton blamed that woman and said anyone who blamed him was probably a Christian fundamentalist and a menace to a woman's right to choose, Raines is setting up the defense that his detractors must be bigots opposed to affirmative action. You posture, champion this righteous cause and that righteous cause, abuse your responsibility, and when you get in trouble, you blame that woman. The bleep set me up. Put aside whether race should be used as a hiring criterion. Even people who support affirmative action don't have to support Raines's approach of refusing to hold blacks responsible for anything ever, including fake reporting. What Raines did to Blair was cruel. Think of it in a non-racial context. Suppose the owner of a big company sends his kid to learn the business and tells low-level managers to treat him just as they would treat anyone else. The managers try to curry favor with the boss by reporting that his son is doing great and is a natural genius for this business. So the kid keeps getting praised and promoted until one day he is actually put in charge of something he has no ability to run. That is cruel. And it's the story of Pinch Sulzberger, isn't it? The Weather's Great, Wish I Were Here, May 21st, 2003. Rio de Janeiro. Actually, I'm in Brooklyn right now, but I'm counting on my employer to follow the strict fact-checking methods in operation at the New York Times. Under the Times' scrupulous reporting procedures, reporter Jason Blair kept turning in reports with datelines from places like West Virginia and Maryland, while submitting expense receipts for the same time period from Joe's Bar in Brooklyn. You can't really blame him. He couldn't very well turn in articles with the dateline, "My Mom's House." In the current Newsweek magazine, Seth Mnookin reports that Blair was forced to resign from the student newspaper at the University of Maryland, the Diamondback, for precisely the same misconduct he engaged in at the Times— phony reporting, plagiarism, irresponsibility, and fantastic lies. Once known as the newspaper of record, the Times is now trying out the motto, almost as accurate as the Maryland Diamondback. Editor Howell Raines ignored Blair's repeated, brazen mendacity. He ignored his editor's urgent demands that Blair be fired. He ignored press conferences in which public officials remarked that Blair's stories were full of lies. Raines ignored it all, until finally one day another newspaper caught Blair plagiarizing one of its stories and blew the whistle on the Times. And then Raines claimed to be shocked to discover that Blair was engaging in a pathological pattern of misrepresentation, fabricating, and deceiving. After all, the Times had issued Blair a series of warnings. One sternly worded memo urged Blair to be more black. This episode is considered a low point in the paper's 152-year history. Not as low as when it endorsed Jimmy Carter, but still pretty low. As has now been widely reported, publisher Arthur Pinch Sulzberger responded to the meltdown at the Times by bringing a stuffed toy moose to an internal meeting with reporters to discuss the burgeoning scandal last week. Also at the meeting, Raines finally admitted the blindingly obvious fact that he engaged in egregious mismanagement because Blair was black. Raines said, "Does that mean I personally favored Jason? Not consciously, but you have a right to ask if I, as a white man from Alabama with those convictions, gave him one chance too many by not stopping his appointment to the sniper team. When I look into my heart for the truth of that, the answer is yes." So, for being a warm-hearted white liberal, he wants a pat on the head, much as his black maid Grady used to give him. Raines said he would not resign, and Pinch said he would not accept Raines' resignation if offered. Which brings us to Pinch. While we are having a debate about diversity and race-based policies, can't we all agree that no one should be defending nepotism? In one of 4 billion columns attacking President Bush this year, Times columnist Maureen Dowd accused him of getting into Yale only because he was a legacy. She sneered at the argument of White House aides that Bush also earned a degree from Harvard Business School, despite there being no Bush relatives who went to Harvard. Dowd responded, "They seemed genuinely surprised when told that Harvard would certainly have recognized the surname and wagered on the future success of the person with it." I believe Sulzberger is a pretty well-known name, too. The Sulzberger Ox dynasty has controlled the most powerful newspaper in the world for the last century. A college admissions committee would not have to wager on young Pinch's future success. It was his birthright to run the New York Times someday. No messy elections could stand in his way. And yet it appears that Harvard managed to turn him down. He was a legacy at Columbia University, but they didn't want him either. Maureen might want to stay mum on the subject of dumb rich kids, at least as long as her boss is Pinch Sulzberger. Like Raines, Pinch blithely washed his hands of the stunning mismanagement at the Times. Commenting through his spokesman, a small stuffed moose, Pinch made the Churchillian pronouncement, "We didn't do this right. We regret that deeply. We feel it deeply. It sucks." Uday Hussein had more right to be in charge of Iraq's Olympic Committee than Pinch Sulzberger does to be running a newspaper. Under the race-based admissions at the University of Michigan, applicants are given 4 points for being a legacy and 20 points for being black. Does anyone think Pinch got only 4 points to be publisher of the Times? Couldn't the Sulzberger family just buy him a boat? Here's a traitor. September 17, 2003. During my recent book tour, I resisted the persistent, illiterate request that I name traitors. With a great deal of charity and suspension of disbelief, I was willing to concede that many liberals were merely fatuous idiots. In addition, I was loath to name names for fear that liberals would start jumping out of windows. But after the Times' despicable editorial on the 2-year anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attack, I am prepared, just this once, to name a traitor. Pinch Sulzberger, publisher of the New York Times. To be sure, if any liberal could legitimately use the stupid defense, it is the one Sulzberger who apparently couldn't get into Columbia University. At a minimum, Columbia has 400 faculty members who start each day by thinking about how to get their kooky ideas onto the Times' op-ed page. For an heir to the Times not to attend Columbia, those must have been some low SAT scores. But the clincher was an editorial on the 2-year anniversary of the September 11th attack, in which the Times endorsed the principle of moral equivalence between the United States and the 9/11 terrorists. In the Times' meandering, mind-numbing prose, it explained that the terrorists might have slaughtered thousands of Americans in a bloody attack on U.S. soil, but the United States has had imperialistic depredations of its own. By not opposing a military coup by the great Augusto Pinochet against a Chilean Marxist, Salvador Allende, the Times implied, the United States was party to a terrorist act similar to the 9/11 attack on America. This is how the Times describes Pinochet's 1973 coup. A building, a symbol of the nation, collapsed in flames in an act of terror that would lead to the deaths of 3,000 people. It was September 11th. Allende was an avowed Marxist who, like Clinton, got into office on a plurality vote. He instantly hosted a months-long visit from Castro, allowing Castro to distribute arms to Chilean leftists. He began destroying Chile's economy at a pace that makes California Governor Gray Davis look like a piker. No less an authority than Zhou Enlai warned Allende that he was pursuing a program that was too extreme for his region. When General Pinochet staged his coup against a Marxist strongman, the United States did not stop him. As if Latin American generals were incapable of doing coups on their own. And, I quote, it was September 11th. Parsed to its essentials, the Times' position is, we deserved it. This from a paper that has become America's leading spokesman for the deposed Ba'athist regime in Iraq. Interestingly, we started to lose this war only after the embedded reporters pulled out. Back when we got the news directly from Iraq, it was all victory and optimism. Now that the news is filtered through the mainstream media here in America, all we hear is death and destruction and quagmire. See if you can detect a pattern in 2 weeks of news at the Treason Times. Since the beginning of the Iraq War, 292 soldiers have been killed in Iraq and Kuwait, including 152 since President Bush declared on May 1st that major American combat operations had ended, September 13, 2003. So far, 290 American troops have died in Iraq or Kuwait since the beginning of the Iraq War, including 150 since President Bush declared on May 1st that major American combat operations had ended, September 12, 2003. It was impossible to watch Mr. Bush's somber speech without remembering that 4 months ago, when the president made his Top Gun landing on an aircraft carrier and declared an end to major combat operations, the White House was worried about giving the world the impression that Americans were gloating. September 8, 2003. The speech was Mr. Bush's first extended address about Iraq since he declared an end to major combat operations in a May 1st speech, September 8, 2003. When President Bush declared an official end to major hostilities in Iraq in May, Reuters moved Dana to Baghdad to give him a safer assignment, September 7, 2003. Since President Bush declared the end of major combat operations in Iraq, hundreds of violent and disruptive attacks have been waged by an array of forces, September 7, 2003. The address will come 4 months after Mr. Bush's last nationally televised primetime speech on Iraq, from the deck of the carrier Abraham Lincoln, where he declared that major combat operations had ended, September 6, 2003. 11 British soldiers have been killed since President Bush declared an end to major combat on May 1, September 5, 2003. Not long after President Bush declared an end to the major fighting in Iraq, Jessica Porter hatched an ambitious plan. She would make a quilt for every family of an American soldier who had died in the war. September 3, 2003. At least 64 American troops have now died from hostile attacks since President Bush declared the end to major combat operations in Iraq on May 1. August 28, 2003. More American troops have now died since President Bush declared an end to major combat on May 1st, then were killed fighting the war in Iraq. August 27, 2003. Hey, does anyone know when Bush declared major combat operations had ended? Because I think there may have been one article in the sports section of the Times last week that didn't mention it. The Times is even taking shots at the war in the arts section, stating authoritatively in a recent movie review, and with the war in Iraq threatening to turn into a Vietnam-like quagmire, how about getting some decent, impartial reporters embedded at the Times? Apparently, the Times' style book now requires all reports of violence anywhere within 1,000 miles of Iraq to be dated from Bush's speech declaring an end to major combat operations. How about dating everything from the day Pinch Sulzberger got his SAT scores back and realized he wasn't going to Columbia University? I gather the Times is trying to convey something by the infernal references to Bush's speech declaring an end to major combat in Iraq, but what? That we haven't turned a savage fascist dictatorship into a peace-loving democracy overnight? Iraq is considerably better off than Chile was under Salvador Allende, the Times' second favorite world leader after Saddam Hussein. CBS could show Augusta how to really discriminate. December 11, 2002. The New York Times is in such a lather about the Augusta National Golf Club's ban on women members, it has briefly interrupted news coverage of The Sopranos to write about it. The outrage over Augusta is not a naturally occurring phenomenon that is simply being reported by the media. It's a synthetic scandal cooked up in the New York Times' PC laboratory. One of the best female golfers in the world, Nancy Lopez of the World Golf Hall of Fame, has said she has no problem with Augusta's policy. But scribblers at the Times have flogged Augusta so relentlessly, it almost seems as if the nation is about to go to war over a golf club's no-girls policy. Anyone who compares the plight of women to the plight of blacks is a racist. Only the bizarre anti-sexual psychology of liberals could fail to grasp the insanity of treating gender like race. Men and women are ineluctably bound to one another. They are also utterly different. Phyllis Schlafly's point that no one wants to end the tradition of separate bathrooms for men and women is so fundamentally true that there is nothing else to be said, except in France, where the practice is common. But it is really more than the public should have to bear to listen to the last bulwark of legal discrimination in America harping about the membership policies of a private club. The media openly discriminate against half of America, Republicans. There is not a single person in any half-important job in the mainstream media who might have voted for Ronald Reagan. That can't be easy. There aren't that many people in the country who didn't vote for Reagan. In 1984, he won the largest electoral landslide in history. Fittingly, the only member to resign in protest from Augusta so far is Thomas Wyman, the former chairman of CBS News, specializing in intolerance for half a century. Wyman was never disturbed by the blatant discrimination at CBS. He proudly presided over a club where membership ran the gamut from Walter Cronkite to Dan Rather. Indeed, CBS was so discriminatory and hateful toward Republicans, there's even a book about it. Bias, by former CBS star reporter Bernard Goldberg. While privileged enforcers of the ideological Jim Crow system, like Wyman, received million-dollar bonuses, talented young journalists were excluded from Wyman's elite media club. Aspiring newsmen who happened to be Republicans had to find work elsewhere or get used to peanut butter for dinner and fourth-floor walk-ups. Dreams were dashed and careers ended. Hearing Wyman complain about discrimination at a golf club would be like hearing Hugh Hefner complain about bawdy language on TV sitcoms. Inasmuch as he hails from the most discriminatory industry in the nation, if Wyman hadn't resigned in a self-righteous snit, he probably could have taught Augusta a few tricks of the trade. Frankly, Augusta has been going about this in entirely the wrong way. Point one, simply deny that Augusta excludes women. Try something like, Augusta is not exclusive, it's humanitarian. This is how CBS's Walter Cronkite explained the employment of only liberals in the mainstream media. It's not liberal, it's humanitarian. Or how about, I have always believed that if you get women out of the way, then decent, reasonable golfers would figure out a way to run a golf club. Don Hewitt, executive producer of CBS's 60 Minutes, said, I have always believed that if you get the NRA out of the way, decent, reasonable Americans would figure out a way to respect the Second Amendment. Point two, claim that both men and women feel they are excluded from Augusta. Cite ludicrous studies proving it. As Leslie Stahl said of the liberal media, everybody complains about us. Right-wing, left-wing, Democrats, Republicans, they all pound on us. They all think we're unfair to them. She said, this big, huge study had concluded that the mainline media is sucked in by the right-wing conspiratorialists. Point three, while openly excluding women, make a big ruckus about any discrimination based on minor, inconsequential differences among men. Commission studies to determine if tall men are getting as much tea time as short men. The glossy magazines won't allow a single Republican to write for them, but they are consumed with grief that not enough models of color have appeared on their covers. Point four, patronizingly instruct women to stop whining and go start their own golf club. Then if they do, attack it. This is what media elites told conservatives for years. We finally got Fox News, and now they savagely denounce it. This is how an entire industry serving the public interest explains its own continuous and ongoing discrimination against half the country. Poor little Augusta just wants to exclude girls from a golf club. Give us 22 minutes, we'll give up the country. February 19, 2003. Rich liberals are planning to fund a talk radio network because they believe, as the New York Times put it, they have been overshadowed in the political propaganda wars by conservative radio and television personalities. If liberals think they are losing elections because of conservative bias in the media, they might as well give up right now. Their first problem is going to be finding liberals who can work on their little project, since they're all already employed at the networks. But liberals insist they need a radio network to counterbalance the conservative tenor of radio programs like The Rush Limbaugh Show. Rush has been driving them crazy for years. In 1994, CNN dedicated an entire program to figuring out how the mainstream media could combat Rush Limbaugh, asking the question, does Rush Limbaugh deserve all this attention, and what should the mainstream media be doing about it? In 1996, the Democratic National Committee went so far as to establish a Speakers Bureau / talk radio initiative to strike back at conservative talk radio by monitoring talk radio and teaching liberals radio skills. Among the alternatives to Rush that liberals have tried over the years are former New York Governor Mario Cuomo, Harvard Law Professor Alan Dershowitz, former Connecticut Governor Lowell Weicker, former California Governor Jerry Brown, former U.S. Senator and monkey business skipper Gary Hart, and former Virginia Governor Doug Wilder. Liberals keep serving up their own dreary radio hosts, and the public keeps turning the dial back to Rush Limbaugh. To be sure, conservative radio talk show hosts have a built-in audience unavailable to liberals, people driving cars to some sort of job. But it should not be surprising that when given a choice, people don't want liberal hectoring being piped into their homes and cars. It would be like being Winston Smith in George Orwell's 1984, forced to listen to Big Brother 24 hours a day. Indeed, it's difficult to imagine a world in which people voluntarily choose to listen to liberals. There is no evidence that it has ever happened. For years, liberals would pass off mediocrities as broadcasting geniuses for surviving the brutal competition of a monopoly. In the pre-cable era, Phil Donahue was promiscuously called a legend, a star, the daytime guru, daytime television's biggest star, even a major star. In 1993, Donahue was inducted into the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences Hall of Fame. His millions of viewers were touted as proof of his massive talent. Of course, back when there were only three TV stations, it was a little difficult to tell whether major stars like Donahue had any talent to attract viewers. Did people actually enjoy watching a man with the IQ of a bright chimpanzee who passed himself off as Bertrand Russell, or did they just want to watch something on TV? Now we have the answer. In a controlled scientific experiment, Donahue was given his own TV show on MSNBC in the new competitive environment of cable TV. That boy's ratings were the lowest in primetime TV for any news program. In fact, his ratings were so low, Nielsen could barely detect them. If only MSNBC could go back and give shows to all the other pompous liberal blowhards once forced on the public, like Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite, we could see how they would have fared with a little competition. My hunch is Nielsen would not have been able to see it now. Liberal speakers lose in all competitive environments. They win only by cheating or by force. One of many failed alternatives to Rush, Jim Hightower recommended that liberals make stronger efforts to insist that their voices be heard. Conservatives, he said, do this all the time. They hammer the networks and the owners to be heard. And that's how we ousted Katie Couric and Dan Rather from the airwaves and ended up with a solid lineup of authentic Americans on ABC, NBC, and CBS. Oh, no, wait. That didn't happen. One thing about liberals is they're pesky devils. They'll never quit. And now they are back again looking for the next liberal alternative to Rush. They have the money, the business consultants, the radio talent. Now all they need are ideas. Ah, there's the rub. The paradox of liberal talk radio is that if liberals cared about ideas or knew any facts, they would cease being liberals. Liberalism thrives on ignorance. Even the audience for the left's government-supported radio network, National Public Radio, has more conservative listeners than liberal listeners. As Mickey Kouse said, no wonder conservatives are so pissed off. According to a Pew Research Center study released in the summer of 2002, conservatives consume far more news than liberals, including listening to NPR and watching PBS more than liberals. Liberals get their news from Lifetime TV for Women, NBC's The West Wing, and 4 billion Law and Order episodes in which the perp turns out to be a white, Christian male who recites the Second Amendment before disemboweling a poor minority child. liberal persuasion consists of the highbrow sneer from self-satisfied snobs ladled out for people with a 40 IQ. This is not an ideology that can withstand several hours a day of caller scrutiny where their goofball notions can be shot down by any truck driver with a cell phone. Journalism, where even the men are women. January 2, 2003. I generally avoid mentioning even widely published lies about me, or I'd never have time to do the things that provoke liberals to lie about me. But inasmuch as one of the media's favorite pastimes is to invent inane quotes and attribute them to conservatives, and then refuse to run corrections, I thought we could use a few real-life examples to examine the ethics of the scribbling profession. One apocryphal quote that has long perplexed me was the one falsely attributed to me in Salon.com by Christina Valhouli, renowned expert on fat farms and squishy tummies. See www.curve-film.com. You don't need to be a size 2 to be a perfect 10. What I never said, but fat farm expert Valhouli thinks I should have said, is this. Women like Pamela Harriman and Patricia Duff are basically Anna Nicole Smith from the waist down. Let's just call it for what it is. They're whores. I don't even understand what that sentence means. Aren't all women basically the same from the waist down? No wonder liberals are so insistent on sex education classes. That quote has now been attributed to me in the Washington Monthly, the Washington Post, and hundreds of websites, all citing Salon.com. I have racked my brain to understand why a fat farm expert and plus-size historian would do me such a bad turn. Readers? Anyone? One of my favorite fabricated statements was the one created for me by Andrew Grossman of The Hollywood Reporter. He was reporting an exchange on the Today Show about my 9/11 column, in which I said of the terrorists and their sympathizers, we should invade their countries, kill their leaders, and convert them to Christianity. Today host Katie Couric asked me if I thought that was the best way to battle terrorism. Here is my precise answer. Well, point one and point two, by the end of the week, had become official government policy. As for converting them to Christianity, I think it might be a good idea to get them on some sort of hobby other than slaughtering infidels. I mean, perhaps that's the Peace Corps, perhaps it's working for Planned Parenthood, but I've never seen the transforming effect of anything like Christianity. Grossman's full account of this exchange in The Hollywood Reporter was, "Do you still believe that's the best way to fight terrorism?" Couric demanded. That quote was taken out of context, Coulter insisted. My parents are still waiting for the day that I formulate an argument as succinct and elegant as, "That was taken out of context, now I'll go back to eating my turkey." Even my worst enemies would not believe I was a non-participant in an argument about me. This is the form of stupidity I admire the most. How should I know how to work LexisNexis? Apart from being a college professor, there is no job in the universe easier than being a journalist. For 99.999% of writers, there is no heavy lifting, no physical danger, no honest day's work. Andrew Grossman has found a way to make it even easier. No research. At the other end of the spectrum are energetic journalists who think all words spoken by Ann Coulter are one long ticker tape that can be cut up and strung together at random to produce any imaginable quote. On December 8, 1998, the topic on Rivera Live was how long an impeachment trial would take. Alan Dershowitz said it would take up to 10 months. Geraldo Rivera said 3 months. Lawyer Roy Black offered the important and persuasive point that people with a brain wanted me to stop talking. This is the relevant exchange about the length of the impeachment trial, which, I note, took about 1 week. Ms. Coulter, The idea that a Senate trial would go on and on and on is absurd. It would take about a week. Professor Dershowitz, can you make a tape of that? Yeah, Geraldo, make a tape of that and replay that over and over again as we get into the 6th week, the 10th week, the 20th week, the 30th week, the 40th week. We'll have Ann Coulter saying, it will take a week. It will take a week. Ms. Coulter, well, I don't know. So far, I could be quoted back to myself many times, like on the Secret Service privilege, the attorney-client privilege, the dead man's privilege. Really, my track record is pretty good on predictions. On another TV show the following March, about the time Hillary Clinton was first thinking about running for the Senate, and her presumed opponent was Rudolph Giuliani, I said I thought Whitewater would prevent Hillary from challenging Giuliani. Giuliani got prostate cancer and decided not to run, so now we'll never know. The Washington Monthly reported my quotes as, I think Whitewater's going to prevent the First Lady from running for Senate. My track record is pretty good on predictions. They get an A for effort on that one. Little Andrew Grossman wouldn't even look up the show he was writing about. These people searched the record for two different quotes, in two different places, on two different TV shows, on two different topics, months apart, reversed the order, and patched them together to try to make a monkey out of me. I've also said, yes. How about stringing these sentences together to make me look brilliant? Question. Will Jimmy Carter win the Nobel Peace Prize, Madonna make a movie that bombs, and North Korea develop nuclear weapons? Ann Coulter. Yes. I think I'm owed that. Most journalists are so stupid, catty, lazy, and vengeful that the fact that they are also humorless is often overlooked. For an example of journalists' fine-tuned sense of humor, consider CBSNews.com's response to the first sentence of my column about the gnashing of teeth over Trent Lott's toast to Strom Thurmond on his 100th birthday. I wrote, I'm just glad Strom Thurmond isn't around to see this. CBSNews.com earnestly corrected me. At last check by CBS News, the world's most famous 100-year-old was doing fine. A People magazine reporter writing a profile on me in 2001 asked me if I had a boyfriend. My precise answer, typed out in an email no less, was, no. When I feel a need for intimacy, I go to an airport security checkpoint. As quoted by People, my answer was, no, I go to an airport security checkpoint. But the winner of Best in Show for Journalists' Great Sense of Humor, sadly, does not involve one of my own quotes. Amid liberal squawking about William Safire's calling Hillary Clinton a congenital liar in his New York Times column, Safire claimed it was a typo and that he meant to say she was a congenital lawyer. That hotbed of liberal wit, The Nation magazine, indignantly responded, sure, Bill, we believe you. Say, that Steno's name wasn't Rosemary Woods, was it? From their commitment to exactitude to their terrific sense of humor, all of the feminists' very best qualities now dominate the profession of journalism. Poor Jason Blair just happened to be the one who got caught. I guess you're right. There is no liberal media bias. October 8, 2003. Response to interview questions of Edward Nowatka of Publishers Weekly. Question. Al Franken claims that there are numerous falsehoods in your book, especially buried in the footnotes. Who is ultimately responsible for the errors, you, the publisher, or both? Coulter. I see we're off to a good start. In your interview with Al Franken, after suggesting that some readers may want Franken to run for president, you ask him hardball questions like, it's got to be a little grating to see your book on the same New York Times bestseller list as the Ann Coulter book. You fact-checked Ann Coulter's book and found a lot of inconsistencies, outright lies, and quotes that are taken out of context. Who is responsible for those kinds of errors, the author or the editors? How should booksellers deal with this? You ask me questions like these. Who is ultimately responsible for the errors in your book? You, the publisher, or both? What gives? Was this an honest mistake or malfeasance, as he suggests? Why all the name-calling? Apparently, Ed, it never occurred to you that Franken's allegations of errors in my book, or outright lies, as you put it, are false. It's interesting that the most devastating examples of my alleged lies keep changing. As soon as one is disproved, I'm asked to respond to another. This is behavior normally associated with tinfoil hat conspiracy theorists. One crackpot argument after another is shot down, but the conspiracy theorists just move on to the next crackpot argument without pause or reconsideration, certainly without apology. So, before responding to the two alleged lies you cite from Franken, the source of all wisdom, I shall run through a few of the alleged lies from Franken's book that I have already been asked to respond to, and which have now been dropped by the Coulter hysterics as they barrel ahead to the next inane charge. Franken's very first charge against me is that I told a reporter from The Observer that I was friendly with Franken, when in fact we are not friendly. Needless to say, I never claimed to be friendly with Al Franken. Inasmuch as I barely know Franken, a normal person might have looked at that and realized the reporter misunderstood me. But apparently Franken thinks he has a pretty cool name to drop, the oddest case of reverse name-dropping I've ever heard of. I don't hear about this lie so much anymore. Franken hysterically accuses me of lying for calling my endnotes footnotes in interviews on my book. Yes, notes at the end of a book are technically endnotes, not footnotes. Franken will have to take his case up with the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the Washington Post, and the rest of the universe, all of which referred to my 780 endnotes as footnotes. Also God, for inventing the concept of colloquial speech. I don't hear so much about this lie anymore. Franken claims I complain that conservatives don't get on TV enough. Inasmuch as I am on TV a lot, this would be a hilarious point. Too bad I never said it. My book Slander, which Franken seems to have gone over with a fine-tooth comb, would have been a good place to make that point if I wanted to make it. Slander contains an entire chapter on the media, and yet I never claim that conservatives are not on TV enough. What I say is, Democrats in the media are editors, national correspondents, news anchors, and reporters. Republicans are from-the-right polemicists grudgingly tolerated within the liberal behemoth. By the way, I also say the distinction between opinion journalism and objective news coverage is seemingly impossible for liberals to grasp. Franken's absurd description of my point proves it. I haven't heard so much about this lie anymore. I claim Evan Thomas's father was the Socialist Party presidential candidate Norman Thomas. Franken drones on and on for a page and a half about how Norman Thomas was not Evan Thomas's father, without saying that he was Evan's grandfather. This was one of about five inconsequential errors quickly corrected in Slander and cited 1 million times by liberals as a lie. Confusing father with grandfather is a mistake. Franken's deliberate implication that there was no relationship whatsoever between Norman and Evan Thomas is intentional dishonesty. I haven't heard so much about this lie anymore. I incorrectly claimed Dale Earnhardt's death was not mentioned on the front page of the New York Times the day after his death. In my three best-selling books, Making the Case for a President's Impeachment, Accusing Liberals of Systematic Lying and Propagandizing, Arguing that Joe McCarthy was a Great American Patriot, and Detailing 50 Years of Treachery by the Democratic Party, this is the only vaguely substantive error the Ann Coulter hysterics have been able to produce, corrected soon after publication. Congratulations, liberals. The Columbia Journalism Review was crowing about this great victory over Ann Coulter a year ago. A search of Coulter and Earnhardt on Google turns up over 1,000 hits. Now Franken dedicates another 2 pages in his book to it. I believe this triumph of theirs has been sufficiently revisited by now. At least I didn't miss the Ukrainian famine. See Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter Walter Duranty. I don't hear so much about this lie anymore. Fraser Moore, a fantasist for the Associated Press, wrote an article accusing me of using routinely sloppy research and contrived facts. Like you, the AP fantasist treats Franken as the source of all wisdom, citing one killer example from Franken. Here's one. On pages 265 to 266, Coulter blasts New York Times writer Thomas Friedman for opposing racial profiling in a December 2001 column. She quotes and credits several passages that seem to back up her complaint. But it turns out that Coulter misappropriated Friedman's words in a way that has nothing to do with racial profiling or anything else addressed in his column, as anyone who reads it will discover. His column actually drew the less than startling conclusion that a new age of terrorism threatens our